I discovered Buffett in the foreword to The Intelligent Investor, and he wrote the foreword for Ben Graham's book. I really liked that foreword. So I looked him up and I realized, oh, there are books about him. He just didn't write the foreword to this book, and he has a whole story to himself as well. Then I didn't stop. I kept looking for new books and obviously all the way to your book, finding out more. So you gave us an idea how the book came about. It was a massive project, 5 years of research. What was it like? You covered 150 years or more of history of the company way before Buffett arrived.
So Chris Blumstrand, a friend, he wrote the foreword to my book. He actually looked up in the Library of Congress and found that there are over 200 titles on Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger. If I was a rational, you know, professional writer, say, you'd never choose Berkshire Hathaway. It's such a crowded field. It came about because I, like you, discovered Buffett and just devoured everything I could find. But I still found myself wanting something more. And so I really pined for a book that was more financial, you know, just more numbers, more of that real depth, as well as a chronological history.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. Welcome to the special episode of Talking Billions. It's Berkshire Hathaway week, and some of you might be heading to Omaha for the company's annual meeting. I'll be there and I might see some of you. Many of you might be following the event online. Others might be new to Buffett and his company. As a special treat this week, I have an episode with Adam Mead for you. Adam wrote an incredible, almost 800-page book about the history of Berkshire Hathaway. I read it all, and I highly recommend it. Berkshire is an investment vehicle managed by Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, two legends in the investment world. There are many books about them and the company, but this one is unique. Adam did an incredible job researching the history of Berkshire long before Buffett's arrival at the helm, leaving us with hints about the future beyond Buffett. If you're a Buffett fan, I think you'll greatly enjoy hearing stories you might be hearing for the first time, or if they're familiar, how we discuss them might offer a new perspective. If you're new to Buffett and Berkshire, it's a great primer in the history of a very successful investing duo and a one-of-a-kind company and over 150 years of economic and industrial change in the United States. We start with the wailing fortunes of the Northeast in the United States. We talk about Hetty Green, a legend of Wall Street of the late 1800s. We continue with the story of the textile industry in America. Then we go on to Buffett's arrival at the company and Berkshire's prosperous growth to the giant it is today, holding a stake in Apple, among others. We'll talk both about the successes and some mishaps too. We'll talk about Salomon Brothers, the airlines, and the textile business. All have been more of a drag on Berkshire's rise. Stay tuned until the end, where we talk about Buffett's lesser-known involvement with Amazon soon after the dot-com bubble burst. Our conversation is a lesson in economic history seen through the experience of one company that changed and evolved and continues to flourish today. My guest today, Adam J. Mead, is a lifelong student of business and capital allocation. He's the CEO and the Chief Investment Officer of Mead Capital Management LLC. Adam is also the founder of WatchlistInvesting.com, a value investing newsletter. Adam spent over a decade in banking in commercial credit, including observing firsthand the after effects of the Great Recession and the long credit expansion afterward. Adam has been investing in public securities markets since 2004. He owned two small businesses during college and grew up in a family of small business owners. In addition to managing assets for his clients at Mead Capital, he's involved with numerous local nonprofit organizations. Adam holds a Master of Business Administration from Southern New Hampshire University. Previously, he graduated summa cum laude from Southern New Hampshire University in 2008 with an undergraduate degree in business studies and a minor in economics. Please help me welcome Adam Mead. Hello, dear listener. I have a new book out. It's a soft launch, and you're among the first to know about it. It's called Crisis Investing. It's a collection of 100 essays, 500 pages, that I wrote to our clients during the global COVID pandemic. I share our lessons from managing family fortunes through one of the most difficult periods in recent history. It's an intimate look behind the scenes, with a retrospective commentary that I added after. The economic and financial backdrop might feel unique to that time, but you'll see that the investment principles shared are timeless. The book includes kind words from Guy Spier, the author of The Education of a Value Investor, William Green, the author of Richer, Wiser, Happier, Lauren Templeton, the author of Investing the Templeton Way, Christopher Mayer, the author of 100 Beggars, Gautam Bate, the author of The Joys of Compounding, James E. Hughes, the author of Complete Family Wealth, Brett Barrett, who's a co-founder and host of the Choose FI podcast, and John Seforek, the author of The Wealthy Gardener, Lessons on Prosperity Between Father and Son. If you're enjoying the show, I think you'll enjoy the book. Head over to Amazon, look it up, Crisis Investing, Bogumil Baranowski, and enjoy a discounted price for both Kindle and paperback. Please review it, rate it, share it. Your support means the world to me. And now, on with the show. All right, Adam, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, as you know, I'm beyond excited. I read your book. It's got almost 800 pages, and I took copious notes from all the pages, and I have more questions for you than usual, and I know you're prepared. I told you you might need extra time to go into a lot of the details. It's a remarkable book. You covered the history of Berkshire Hathaway, and you went way beyond Buffett, and you told us where this company came from. But before we jump into all the questions, I like to start from the beginning, and I like to ask my guests about their childhood and upbringing, and I'm curious how you think that influenced your relationship with money and paved the way to your interest and career in investing, and eventually this book that took up 5 years of your life.
Yeah, so it's a good question. It's a good place to start. I've always been around business. I mean, my family, even, you know, going back to my great-great-great-grandfather who owned his own farm and came over. But so this sort of lineage of small business owners is one that runs deep in my family. And so growing up, my grandfather had and my uncles ran a tree service business. My father had a trucking company. He later got into real estate. And so I always had business and money around me. And so it was never, you know, it's just always, you know, couple that with a natural curiosity and, well, how does this work? And I can remember as a kid just asking my father, okay, how do you get paid for bringing this truck thing, the trailer, from A to B? And like, how do you find the work? That just sort of just engrossing myself in all aspects of it, just that curiosity. So that sort of naturally led to, so in high school, I actually cut, split, and sold firewood. That was sort of my first introduction into business. And it's a simple business, but it's one that really helped me put the meat on the bones when I went to school, because it's, you can wrap up all these different aspects, and I could talk about this forever, but input costs and, you know, get my brother and a friend to work for me for a little while, and just the difficulties with labor and storing inventory and the risk that the market price would change on the wood, and just a basic commodity in type of industry where you could only sell it for what the market was. So all of these things, you know, some receivables, just like all of these things were just a great framework. I could think back and say, oh, okay. So when I learned it in school, this is in my firewood business, this would be this. In college, this might surprise you. I raced motocross as a kid and up through college. And so I actually started a welding business fixing the motocross pipes. And so that was another one, you know, just where hands-on. I actually formed an LLC. This was, I probably didn't have to, but it was like, okay, I'm going to make this official. I'm going to form an LLC and have an operating agreement and my own checking account, like just jumping in. And so the natural extension to investing. And so anybody, I mean, Bogumil, anybody in business, you're going to hit Warren Buffett at some point in your career. It'd be interesting if someone could actually go through their business life without actually learning about Warren Buffett. So found Warren Buffett, and it was just, you know, he says about the intelligent investor, you know, the scales just kind of fell from my eyes, and it was just like, this is it, right? Like, this is stocks or businesses. I get it. Tell me more. And so that was just one thing led to another. My grandmother another interesting story. My great-grandmother left some shares to her. And so growing up, even before I was 18, I had experience with shares and got into a drip program and learned about dividends and where does this money come from. And age 18, opened my own brokerage account. I've made all the mistakes in the world. Recorded all of these in a file I called the Folly Gallery. So I rubbed my nose in it. But from the beginning, business to investing to where I am today, and ultimately said, you know what? I think I know enough to write a book about Berkshire Hathaway. And so that led to that ultimately.
Wow, you touched on so many things. So mistakes, I think the best thing that an investor can do is to start with a mistake, lose money in the first investment. And whenever I give talks about investing, I ask the audience, have you made money in stocks? Have you lost money in your first investments? And I think it can take you in a different direction. You might think it's easy, especially if you make a lot in the first investment. And it's very humbling to see the impact, the emotional impact of a mistake, and just take a step back and think about risks. I love motorcycles, by the way. So I had a Ducati for a long time, and I have a dirt bike, so I can relate to your passion for the two wheels. In terms of, you know, discovering investing, interesting that you mentioned that a lot of people eventually discover Buffett. I discovered Buffett in the foreword to The Intelligent Investor, and he wrote the foreword for Ben Graham's book. I really like that foreword. It was the first time I've heard about him. I just didn't know who he was. So I looked him up and I realized, oh, there are books about him. He just didn't write the foreword to this book. And he has a whole story to himself as well. So that was my discovery of Buffett. And then I didn't stop. I kept looking for new books and obviously all the way to your book, finding out more. So you gave us an idea how the book came about. It was a massive project, five years of research. What was it like? How did you organize yourself? How do you even get started on, you covered 150 years or more of history of the company way before Buffett arrived.
Yeah, so it was kind of one of these things. So Chris Blumstrand, a friend, he wrote the foreword to my book. He actually looked up in the Library of Congress and found that there are over 200 titles on Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger. If I was a rational, you know, professional writer, say, you'd never choose Berkshire Hathaway. It's such a crowded field. It came about because I, like you, discovered Buffett and just devoured everything I could find. But I still found myself wanting something more. So Barron, you know, in his letters would say, okay, you know, the MSR businesses earned 16% return on tangible capital, and he'd go on. And I'd say, okay, well, how did he get these numbers? And go into the financials. And so I really pined for a book that was more financial, you know, just mm-hmm. more numbers, more of that real depth, as well as a chronological history. Alice Schroeder wrote Snowball, a lot of good stuff in there. I think of that book as more qualitative, where my book is the quantitative. So my original idea, and I had kicked around a couple of different ideas, you know, I said, well, geez, how do I do this? Do I pull out like the management discussion analysis section from each sort of segment and then put those together chronologically? This was maybe like 2015, something like that, just kind of throwing out ideas. And then I kind of just settled on, well, let's take Berkshire in 10-year chunks, go year by year, but, you know, just sort of pause at the end of each decade and just see how the businesses had changed, see the capital allocation decisions, obviously lots of numbers. And so my original idea was to go from 1955, which was a decade before Warren took over, and then go forward in these decade-long chapters year by year. So I sent Warren the first two chapters covering 55 to 74. And to my delight, he wrote back and said, you know, thank you for writing this book, but wouldn't it be interesting if you went back to the World War II era and, uh-huh. and just look at these businesses, the sort of spike in profitability that they got from World War II. And so, I mean, like any dedicated value investor, invest with Warren Buffett, I'm going to go back. And so I went back and I just started doing all this research. And I said, you know what, if I'm going back this far, the curiosity got the better of me. Let's go back even further. And so that led me to the late 1800s. I went a little bit further and said, okay, how did textiles get into New England? And that's an interesting story in itself. But I just said, I'll go back to the 1800s and saw all these little textile businesses, how they all converged and ultimately became Berkshire Hathaway. And so that became the starting point of the book all the way through to 2019. So it is, full disclaimer for listeners, it's now the incomplete financial history of Berkshire Hathaway. I'm always on that treadmill because time doesn't stop, but, and we will do an update at some point. But I kind of wrote the book for the new shareholder that just looks at this company and says, oh my gosh, how do I even begin? You know, you can go from the beginning, you can pick an era and look at it and have a way to digest it. And then for someone like you or me, who's more versed in Berkshire's history, if it serves as a reference guide, you know, that's fine with me too. I certainly don't expect everyone to read all 750 pages of my 2.5-pound doorstopper.
I think we're both historians, and especially if I find a company that I invest in and it's been around for 100 years, I'm so curious how it got started. Who were the people at the beginning? What was it like? And you did that for Buffett's Berkshire. So today, anybody looking at Berkshire, they're thinking of a massive conglomerate that has all kinds of businesses that we'll talk about in a minute. But it started as a textile business, and that textile business went through its ups and downs and all the way until it got shut down by Buffett himself. But you mention Hetty Green. Hetty Green is considered the grandmother of value investing, and you and I briefly talked about her. And you mention her, and you mention the wailing fortunes of the Northeast that gave the capital to the textile industry at the time. Can you talk about her and how much you know, and how does she fit in the picture, and the whole phenomenon, a big picture idea of the capital traveling from a dying industry to the next industry that promised a lot of potential. And I mean, all the way to today, you know, textiles are gone in that sense, but the capital, the wealth continued. So let's start with the wailing fortunes and Hetty Green. I know it's a big question, but how does she belong to this history?
Yeah, sure. No, it's fascinating. And that was always the temptation. You're right. I would put myself in the historian category. And I'm fortunate to, I live in New Hampshire, which is less than an hour's drive to Boston, Massachusetts, where I could take up shop in the Boston Public Library. And Berkshire Hathaway was domiciled, and most of the predecessor companies were domiciled in Massachusetts. So I could actually go in and look at all of the corporate card files. And at the time, you had to have approval from the state to actually increase your capital. And so you have all these little corporate cards. I think I posted some of those on my website. Just fascinating history. I mean, you could do a whole book just on, you know, the sort of early history of Berkshire. But it's interesting to just take a step back and just sort of see how this all materialized and then ultimately became Warren Buffett's investment vehicle. So I think it was 1789, a guy by the name of Samuel Slater snuck out the technology from England on how to make a textile mill. You know, we kind of think about this, you know, all that's quaint, but it's equivalent to today's corporate scandals, international scandals of, you know, the Chinese coming in and stealing manufacturing secrets from the United States. I mean, that's how serious this was.
Right.
So, of course, the technology is going to spread. Mid-1800s, these little mills really start to crop up. They started in New England for the reason you mentioned. Well, two reasons. One was, so the whaling fleet of, you know, sort of 1800s, the whaling oil, the sperm whale oil, the blubber, they'd render it down. That was useful for lighting and cooking and so forth. So these whaling fleets came out of New England, very valuable, built up all these fortunes. And so the capital was in place. And then, of course, oil was discovered in the ground, renders whaling, you know, useless. And so all of this capital is sitting there with needing a place to be put to work. Now we have these mills coming in. And in New England, we have a lot of powerful rivers. And so you have the ingredients necessary to combine capital with natural resources and, of course, the know-how of how to do these mills. And so these combine, and you have the birth of the textile industry in the United States. And, you know, these mills in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and Fall River, which is where Berkshire's early subsidiaries were based, Lowell, Massachusetts, another big one, even right up here in Manchester, New Hampshire, one of the first fully integrated mills. And so, you know, this just unleashes onto New England. And Hetty Green, who you mentioned, sort of the, I think she's been called, you know, the first woman of Wall Street. And so she has this fortune, partly from whaling, and she invests in all these startups. And she was one of the first investors in Hathaway Manufacturing. And so Hathaway, it's interesting, and again, you could just sort of go on forever on this, but the Berkshire side of Berkshire Hathaway was the result of about half a dozen to a dozen little mills that started to fail, had some difficulties, merged together, created Berkshire Fine Spinning Associates in 1929, and Hathaway Manufacturing sort of stayed as a parallel track to all of these as its own entities. It was originally started in 1885, then incorporated in 1889. And then the Berkshire Fine Spinning and Hathaway Manufacturing merged in 1955, creating Berkshire Hathaway. And then 10 years later, Warren Buffett came into the picture.
Wow. I have so many questions about what's about to happen at that time when Buffett arrives. But before that, I just wanted to mention, for anybody curious, Hetty Green was very famous for being a bargain shopper when it comes to securities. And she would buy them when nobody wanted them. So it was the fear and greed idea that Buffett promoted later on, but she was really remarkable about it. I don't know if she was a nice person to be around from the stories that I've read, but she was an incredible investor and turned her inherited fortune to an even bigger fortune from what I know. And I had no idea that she had a Berkshire Hathaway connection that you mentioned. Now, Buffett shows up, and Berkshire was not really meant to be a forever investment for him, from what I understand. And because Buffett is very particular about the price, he was about to sell it, and the price wasn't right, and he ended up buying the whole thing. Can you tell us the story? So I know that there would be Buffett no matter what, but it wouldn't necessarily be the case that Berkshire would be Buffett's, right? That's how I look at it. There was a moment in history that he could have walked away.
Yeah, it was an accident, and Buffett has even said it was a mistake to make it his investment vehicle. And so, and just sort of connecting what we just talked about, so 1955, these two companies merge, create Berkshire Hathaway, and of course, you read these early annual reports, and it's okay, you know, basically all this jargon, we're going to get synergies, and you know, sort of all this stuff. Well, that didn't really happen. They still faced a lot of difficulties in the operating environment. But what is really interesting is that I concluded that management, with the exception of, and I think would almost be impossible to do if you spent your life as a textile, you know, businessman.
To think outside of that box, right?
Yeah, just thinking outside that box. So Buffett came in and reallocated the capital, but they actually did a pretty good job allocating the capital in terms of closing mills, and they were buying back their shares. And so they shrunk the business by about half from 1955 to 1965. And so Buffett comes in, his training is through Ben Graham, cigar butt investing, buying these companies for less than their, you know, cash or working capital, and then flipping them, essentially. Mm-hmm. Warren comes in, sees this struggling textile business, concludes that it's a good, you know, cigar butt investment. This is like 1962. He starts buying shares at about $7.50, with the idea that when another tender offer comes up, he'll tender his shares. And so he meets with Seabury Stanton, Berkshire's president, chairman and president at the time. I think it was chair, definitely president, and says, you know, basically comes to this sort of handshake agreement. Next time you have a tender offer, I'll sell, you know, at $11.50. The tender offer comes in and it's, you know, for 11 3/8, you know, 12 and a half cents below what he was told or to expect. And so he, you know, just kind of flips out, I guess, lack of a better term, and says, you know, I'm going to buy control of this business. And that's what he does. And he did have support from the Chase family, who was one of the founders, I think, of the Valley Falls Company, one of the early predecessor companies, gets support from the Chase family and ultimately gains control of Berkshire Hathaway on May 5th, 1965. And so that's the beginning, and that that creates this investment vehicle. And again, he has said that it was a mistake. He should have just taken capital and started something to invest in, but instead he basically made Berkshire his investment vehicle and took along some other shareholders for the ride.
He ended up owning a business he didn't really want to own. And what's interesting to me, I think, and I don't know what the tipping point was, but he was evolving from somebody that was doing deals like you described, where he would basically wait until somebody buys him out or just get a quick gain and move on to the next thing, to holding businesses for the long run. And I'm thinking of See's Candy, and I don't know if this is the particular story that started him on the journey of owning businesses for the long run. But here we see Skendi, he was also particular about the price. So you can talk more about the business and the idea that he almost didn't pay up for it, almost walked away from it as well, if I remember correctly, but then grew to appreciate a quality business that you can hold, you know, pretty much forever. Do you want to talk about See's Candy? I feel like it's a shift in the mindset to owning quality businesses and a whole new journey for Buffett and for Berkshire.
Yeah, and that, so See's was 1972. So this, so you know, we still have 7 years in there between Berkshire and See's. And so even at the beginning, Buffett comes in and just takes control of this business and realizes, you know, kind of just go back to what we said before, his capital is fungible for him. Mm-hmm. And so he buys National Indemnity, which is a huge turning point in Berkshire's history, in 1967. And then in 1969, he buys the Illinois National Bank and Trust of Rockford, 1969, and has a great run with that. We're very good businesses, but I think you alluded to the real quality company in a company like See's. That took a Charlie Munger to say, look at the quality of this. 3x book value. The purchase price was $35 million. They had $10 million of cash on the book. So, you know, sort of the effective purchase price is $25 million. And Buffett has said if they asked $100,000 more, they would have walked. And so he was still extremely price sensitive. And, you know, I don't know what exactly it was, you know, just coupled with, again, Charlie Munger and looking at the earnings history of this thing and getting comfortable with paying a multiple of book value. Cause, you know, I forget the exact multiple of the bank. It might have been 1.07x book value. Very low, very low multiple to book value. So it was like, this was the magnitude of the stretch that he took with See's Candy, I don't think can be overstated.
So we'll come back to the insurance business that I'm really curious about because it's a big theme for Buffett. But to me, See's Candy was, you're right, that's Munger's influence, that he was just looking outside of the businesses he knew so far, it seems to me. And he was looking at the quality and being married to a business forever. And since you already mentioned the insurance, I'm curious if you could show us the themes of different industries that Buffett liked over the years. And I know it's a lot of history, but the 50 years that we're about to embark on, you mentioned insurance, you mentioned banks, I'm sure you'll mention newspaper, and we just mentioned See's Candy, which is a category in itself that he, if you think of it as a consumer goods, that he explored down the road. But can we talk about, if you're introducing a new shareholder, we went from textiles all the way to multiple industries, but not all industries. Buffett and Munger have been really picky about which industries they want to be in. Do you want to talk about that? I'm very curious about the big themes within the conglomerate of the collection of businesses.
Yeah. And so I think, and just to kind of tie it into See's, I think by the time, you know, Buffett, so he was born in 1930. So by the 1950s, you know, he's already in his 20s. He's starting this partnership up, you know, buys control of Berkshire Hathaway. I think he had enough experience, you know, Dempster Mill, you know, just all these early businesses. I think Charlie has even said this, he would have gotten there on his own. I mean, he's a smart enough guy. He would have gotten there on his own. I think there's an element of that because, I mean, he had had such a history of buying these businesses and probably realized, yeah, let's buy some better businesses, pay up a little bit. We don't have to do so much work. We can sit around, we can have some good business problems. And I think part of that was probably the Illinois National Bank and Trust of Rockford, this guy, Gene Abegg. And Buffett has made the comment that with him, there were all these positive surprises. Oh, geez, you know, I forgot that we had this asset over here that I didn't tell you about. And you know, all these positive things where with the textile mill, it was all these problems, problem after problem after problem. And so Buffett got there. And so again, sort of 1965 to, again, I'm thinking in these decade-long chunks of odd, but when it's put in Buffett's 10-year term, it kind of makes sense. So 65 to 74, that this first decade, he buys National Indemnity, he buys C's through blue chip stamps, the bank. They had a little publishing business as well, invests in the Washington Post at that point. So that's that the newspaper connection. Starts to look for better businesses. And again, the newspapers, very simple thesis. Newspapers were the key deliverer of information. There really wasn't an alternative. And he could see that two newspaper towns were going to one newspaper towns. If you picked the winner, you would prosper right alongside it. So that continued into the sort of next decade, 75 to 84. They bought the Buffalo News. They merged with Blue Chip Stamps in 1983. They bought Nebraska Furniture Mart. You know, nice, simple businesses with identifiable competitive advantages. Now, there is a little asterisk of a mistake in here. In 1975, they purchased Wambeck Mills of Manchester, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Ended up being a mistake. They actually bought it for below book value. They didn't have any physical assets on the books. Right. It was sort of this cutting and distribution center, but Buffett couldn't help himself. But by 1985, that had been corrected. The textile business completely shut down by 1985, 1986. So then they really start to, and you can please stop me at any time if you want to.
No, go ahead.
Now Berkshire starts to get some size. 1985 to 94. They're small enough to be nimble, but large enough to do some big deals. So a couple that stand out in this decade, 1986, so they buy Scott Fetzer. The effective purchase price was somewhere around $235 million. Headline number was, I think, $410. They had, again, excess cash in the book, so I just net that out. But that doubled Berkshire's revenue base. It added about $700 million worth of revenues. And this was a little mini conglomerate of its own. 20% of its revenues were Kirby vacuum cleaners, the other 20%. Another 20% was World Book encyclopedias. And then they had about 18 other little businesses in all kinds of different industrial end markets. So again, nothing really flashy. They bought some shoe companies during this time, simple businesses. They had an investment in Wesco, which in turn had a bank in Mutual Savings run by Munger. But then they start doing these other things. And these businesses, like, so Scott Fetzer and another business, a uniform manufacturer, Feckheimer, these were actually either failed leveraged buyouts or, you know, ESOP, you know, management buyouts, one way or another didn't happen. But what's really interesting is you look at these things and you can think to yourself, okay, well, interest rates were higher, you know, some inflation and so forth. But these businesses were earning 25% on capital in the case of Scott Fetzer to 50% on capital for Feckheimer. And they just get passed over. Like how, you know, very simple businesses that Buffett would just write letters or just scoop up into Berkshire Hathaway. Nothing really complicated. But then you had in 1985, they took an investment, I think it was 18% in Capital Cities. And they helped Capital Cities buy, so they first had investment in Capital Cities, and they helped Capital Cities buy ABC. That right. investment was ultimately merged into Disney. But you see in this period, Buffett sort of, again, size to do almost anything, but still nimble enough, and was kind of getting that. This is where his name started to get out there. Mm-hmm. But they did something interesting with Capital Cities. They made this big investment, but they gave the management team a vote of their proxy. So they basically said, "We're going to own a big chunk of you."
That's true.
We think so highly of these managers that, you know, we don't want you to have any fear that we're going to step in and just tell you what to do. Uh-huh. You take our votes. You know, so it was making this public investment essentially private in a way, just really, really interesting, different, very different. They also invested in Salomon at this point in 1987.
That took a lot of, that was a big trouble and took a lot of time and attention.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. I'm curious
because
you talked about private and public, and a lot of people know Buffett as the public market investor that bought stakes in big companies that everybody recognizes, but he bought entire companies in the process. And can you talk about the differences? And he hints here and there about the different mindsets. So in the public market, you can have a true distressed seller more often because of the whole market selling off or individual stock selling off. Private market, you mentioned the distress sometimes that happened. It's a bit different. And then the control in a public market, and in this case, when you mentioned ABC, they didn't even want to exercise much of a control. They wanted the management to run it. Can you talk about the private versus public mindset that Buffett played both sides all those years, participating in both sides of the market? And when I say private, I don't mean private equity borrowing money and making deals, how people think of private these days. That's not how he was operating. He was buying the entire businesses.
Yeah, I think it really, to me, hammers home the point that stocks are businesses, you know, they're the same thing.
Right.
They're two sides of the same coin. I think I've termed it the portfolio approach. You know, Buffett and Munger have had this famously hands-off approach to managing Berkshire's sprawling empire. And I think that's one reason why it's actually worked, you know, in addition to just sort of the logistical challenges of managing and keeping track of everything. But in terms of the incredible power of motivating these individual managers with trust. But I've termed it the portfolio approach. Now, their upbringing was picking stocks, right? And when you're buying stocks, unless you're buying control, but many, or if not all, or most of their investments in their earlier days were just public investments. They didn't have control. They didn't have say what happened in operations. So they had this training and this mental attitude of buying a piece of a corporation for a certain economic characteristic, whether it was going to be taken over in some sort of corporate event, or they were holding it until the value was realized. Now make that shift to, okay, now we're going to buy an entire business, like a Scott Fetzer, who has Ralph Shea at the helm, credible manager. Maybe they said this to themselves, but I think they realize, what's the difference between owning 3, 4, or 5% of a company and owning 100%? Other than we have more claim on the cash flow and we technically have the legal ability to direct this corporation. But in their minds, you know, they could take a portfolio approach to private businesses and say, well, okay, so what, we own 100% of this. We're still going to let the manager run it and do his thing. I mean, they certainly were not hands-off operators. They were paying attention, learning from these managers and asking them questions. And, you know, there's an interesting letter from Buffett to Chuck Huggins at Sees. Buffett was traveling somewhere and said, geez, you know, I saw one of our displays was, you know, kind of messy. And, you know, here's some ideas of how to sort of play up this. Like, he was active in that sense, but he really would trust these managers. And so it was very much the case that he treated these the same, the public, public investments. It's just, as you said, that the public market could offer up these crazy deals at times with stocks being, you know, just beaten down for unnecessary reasons. And then with the private businesses, it was, you know, just flukes, or people didn't quite appreciate the value, or, you know, eventually it became, well, Berkshire Hathaway is this home for these businesses. The founders actually wanted it to be in a place that would be protected and wouldn't be leveraged up, like you said, into sort of a traditional private equity sense. It was, here's this business, you know, you operate it to the best of your ability.
I think of it as an exit strategy for a lot of those businesses, right? And a safe exit strategy. So you wouldn't be put in the hands of private equity that would load it with debt and hold it for 3-5 years until they get the returns they're hoping for, make massive changes to the business to show the margins that can be even higher for a brief period of time, and then hopefully try to sell it or list it and get rid of it. That was not Buffett's way of operating. So that's a very different mindset about buying a whole business and holding it hopefully forever. And I think that's a very different message and a different seller that would come to somebody like Buffett because of that. The big theme across your book and the history of Berkshire is a concentrated portfolio. And you kind of highlight it every decade, how much of the portfolio of Berkshire is in very few large investments. And in one place, I think you hint that it might be a shortage of investment candidates at the time, but it continued throughout time. So I think that there's a big theme of highest conviction ideas and a very high comfort with having so much of the wealth in very few ideas, very different than a traditional investment management, you know, profession and diversification mindset of having many, many, many stocks across many sectors. Can you talk about that? Concentration.
Yeah, the concentration has been just part of the playbook, really. And I think it reflects this idea that this commitment, you know, you have to have a very high threshold. Ideas are scarce. And so when you get a good idea and it's a good price, you make a big bet. The Illinois National Bank that I mentioned was actually, so that was 1969. And I looked at, these are small. I mean, I think they paid $17 million for that bank. I could be wrong on that, but these numbers get very small mm-hmm. compared to today. But when you look at it as a percentage of Berkshire's equity capital at the time, that Rockford Bank was 44% of Berkshire's equity capital when they made that investment. Even bigger than National Indemnity, which was about 30% in 1967. But you see both on the common stock public investment side and the wholly owned businesses that they invest in, this continual concentration of bets. And so the largest single common stock investment across all of these decades was no less than, I think, 25%. Mm-hmm. Top four were frequently, you know, half to even 75% of the portfolio. And we see that even today. But you walk through these acquisitions, you know, Buffalo News, 15%. Scott Fetzer was around 20%. General Re in 1988, I think 18%, BNSF, 18% of equity capital. And so you see this theme. Now, of course, the question becomes, the challenge becomes, okay, now Berkshire Hathaway has $500 billion worth of equity capital. A 15% investment is $75 billion. That the universe of companies is just so small. And so sort of part and parcel to that is Apple. You know, Apple today, $150 billion investment. That's just continuing this playbook of large investments. But to make another wholly owned acquisition of that magnitude, you know, there's only a handful of companies that could meet that test. And you look at the common stock portfolio today, and CNBC has this wonderful tracker in live and in real time of the value of it as a percentage of the portfolio, and as well as the percentage of the company that Berkshire owns. And you go down the list, and it's, you know, some of the big ones, of course, Coca-Cola, they own almost 10% of the company, American Express, 20% of that, Kraft Heinz, 26%. But there's a lot that are at that 9.9, you know, 9%, 5%. Berkshire owns a big chunk of a lot of companies. And in addition to the ones that it owns 100% of, it becomes a challenge. But this theme has not stopped. And you could even make the argument that Berkshire itself is now sort of that large investment, right? Over the last 3 years or so, they've invested over $50 billion in share repurchases. That's sort of the next whale. And it's mm-hmm. just happening right in front of us. So where it goes from here, I'm not 100% sure, but I think they'll continue to execute on that.
When I think of that concentration, I'm thinking of the coffee can portfolio. I'm sure you're familiar mm-hmm. with the story. Basically, the idea was a lot of investors trade in and out of positions, but the idea is if you have a high conviction idea, just buy it and never sell and keep on adding into a coffee can of sorts. And after many years, and there's an article by Robert Kirby, I believe, about that story, the portfolio mm-hmm. that he followed has become really strange. So you would have massive positions in very few stocks that have succeeded, that have grown, and then tiny, tiny positions in the ideas that haven't worked out. And I think, I don't know if Buffett intended that, but in the last letter, the 2022 letter, he mentions investment in Coca-Cola and in U.S. treasuries. And how if you put the same amount, I don't know if it was a billion he was talking about. He likes to talk in billions, 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion. So I'm guessing it was a billion. That after so many years, the Coca-Cola investment is tens of billions today. And the treasuries would have been not much more. So what happens is the most successful businesses, by definition, will take up a bigger and bigger portion of the portfolio if you let them be. So if you have a mindset of buying quality and never selling unless you're really forced to, or somebody buys it from you, which happened, and we'll talk about it, then the portfolio will, by definition, become highly concentrated, right? Like the success of those few ideas will take up a lot of room in the portfolio. And that's been the case for all those years at Berkshire. I'm curious about taxes. Buffett mentions his take on taxes here and there, and he says that the tax authority is the shareholder with the best class, because the shareholder can decide how big of a share of the profits they get to take and when they get to take it. But he has played the game of deferred taxation. So basically, he hasn't realized gains in a lot of holdings for a long time. And then we can talk more about it, but he had those unique deals with Graham Holdings, Washington Post, and Duracell, and probably others that you mentioned in the book, where there were no tax consequences or maybe minimal tax consequences when he basically sold them. So can you walk us through taxes? So investors talk and think about taxes at the same time as we're, you know, excited about returns, but we know that somebody has a claim on those returns before we can spend them.
Yeah, and you mentioned that that sort of analogy or metaphor of, I think Buffett has called it, you know, the AA class of Berkshire shares, which is the percent that the government quite literally owns,
yeah,
by virtue of its taxing power. And even just that thought, I mean, I love when Buffett puts things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, oh, that makes total sense. You know, just from an economic equivalent, they own a portion of Berkshire by virtue of their I mean, it's just those, that thinking process, just distilling it to such simplicity. I just love it. I just love those moments when Buffett can do that. It's almost, people have said he is, you know, inconsistent or, you know, a hypocrite or what have you, because on the one hand, he says he's advocating for higher taxes, but yet he does everything in his power not to pay them. And I think it's reconciled by the fact that he's trying to call attention to this from a societal standpoint. You know, if everybody did this, you know, that this policy should be this way. But he also has a deep, deep fiduciary responsibility to his shareholders. Right. So he's saying, I think the rules should be this way, but if collectively as a society, we're deciding and it's going to be this way, I'm going to play by the rules. So that's really interesting. So he's, again, deferred taxes is a big one. So you mentioned Coca-Cola. Interestingly, this is just a coincidence, American Express and Coca-Cola, Berkshire's cost basis is $1.299 billion. Coca-Cola is worth about $25 billion today. Hasn't sold or added to the position since. But deferred taxes, you have an incredible, and I've written about this, you just have this incredible compounding power on your behalf, because you're getting an interest-free loan from the government by not selling the shares. And again, there people say, well, Jesus, that's not fair. I've modeled out the math, and the U.S. Treasury, the taxing authority, actually benefits just as much as the investor. So it's not like it's completely unfair. It's just it's just the way it works, just the way the math mm-hmm. works. So you have this happening with some of these long held investments. But you mentioned Graham Holdings, which is a holdover from the Washington Post investment. You know, in 1973, they paid $10 million for this stake that became billions. Duracell is a result of Procter and Gamble investment, originally in a Gillette investment in the 80s. And they did what's called a cash-rich spinoff. So basically, so the Graham Holdings case, Graham Holdings owned some Berkshire Hathaway shares. Well, actually, Graham Holdings was a swap. They owned some, I think there was a cash component too, but they owned some Berkshire shares. Berkshire owned some Graham Holdings shares, and they just swapped them, no tax implication. Duracell, which was called a cash-rich split off. Procter & Gamble put the Duracell business and some cash in a company, and then Berkshire swapped its shares in Procter & Gamble for this other entity, got cash, and got Duracell. There's all kinds of rules related to this. You have to hold it for, I think, 5 years, you know, and so forth. But that's the tax code, right? Mm-hmm. And so they were able to make these tax advantaged moves, and they've done this, you know, where it has made sense. They do it in a very big way at the energy business, Berkshire Hathaway Energy, where if you look at their income statement, they've for many years had a negative tax rate, negative taxes. They actually get a credit. And that's they wouldn't if they weren't a part of Berkshire Hathaway with a huge tax bill. But that energy business gets to take advantage of solar and wind and renewable tax credits, which again, that's the playbook. And, you know, I may be biased, but I think it's probably the right policy for the United States to get this infrastructure in right. place. So again, Buffett finds himself in this interesting spot of playing by the rules, but advocating for them to be changed against Berkshire's best interest at the moment. So different from others that spend a lot of money lobbying to make things easier for themselves.
I was thinking about the tax liability. So if you become a new shareholder tomorrow, how do you think about the tax liability that comes with it? Have you thought about that dimension of an investment in Berkshire if they were to ever realize some of those gains in the future?
Yeah, so I think the difference there, and I haven't really thought too much about that, I think the difference there would be, so this happens with mutual funds. If you buy into a mutual fund and they sell some shares, you get a pass-through capital gain. So you could be a brand new mutual fund shareholder, and then all of a sudden at the end of the year, get hit with a huge tax bill. You say, well, I didn't sell any shares. I actually had a loss or something. It's just the way that it works. I think with Berkshire, it's a little bit different because they're a C corp. You wouldn't get a pass-through tax bill, but I guess you could in theory from an economic standpoint. If Berkshire, again, if they sold it, say they sold all of their Coca-Cola tomorrow, they would owe tax on a gain of about $25 billion.
Right.
So, you know, they'd owe, what, $5 billion. That would be real cash going out the door at Berkshire. It would represent a real diminishment of their earnings power. And so maybe the share price would get hit. But I think you're onto something there in a sense, but technically there's a little bit of a difference. It's interesting though. That's an interesting thought.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a difference between the traditional mutual fund and what they're doing. But I always thought about it if anybody comes in and changes how things are done and wants to redo the portfolio. It's a coffee can portfolio in many ways. So you're stuck with big gains. And the difference is that if you're an individual that inherits, we work with families that have had wealth for many generations, multi-generational wealth. And in the US, at least, you have the step up in cost basis at times that people can benefit from. So if you inherit shares, the cost gets reset based on the day of death of the individual. But for a corporate entity like here, it goes on for the next 100 years and more with the gains that have been booked. Obviously, down the road, the future gains can dwarf the gains of today's Coca-Cola or even Apple, who can even imagine what Berkshire will end up investing in. So I think it's an ongoing thing to spend a few seconds about. I think the benefit of owning Berkshire is separate from this discussion, but it's something to think about. Since they deferred taxes for so long, they're due one day.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to sort of to write about and think about. And what comes to mind is SunTrust. So SunTrust was the bank in Georgia that I think helped underwrite Coca-Cola. And so if on their books for many years, they had basically Coca-Cola shares for free. huge unrealized capital gains. And SunTrust sold their Berkshire shares. And so SunTrust, I think, is now part of Truist, but that's sort of a similar dynamic here. Like that could be the canary in the coal mine. You know, does these future managers, are they going to sell Coca-Cola? Is that sort of like a red flag to watch out for? Because I effectively, and what's interesting too, if you look into the dynamics and the math behind deferred taxes, Berkshire can. It's just amazing the way this works. But even if Coca-Cola's earnings power diminishes significantly below where you would buy it today, it's still a rational course of action for Berkshire to hold it, because if they were to sell it, pay the taxes, reinvest it, what you have to get is so high. So it's just again, you sort of think about this. Is it just happenstance, or was it something that they actually thought about? But deferring taxes, holding on to an investment for so long, you have this built-in counter force to basically what's sort of inevitable with every company, which is a decline in their earnings power over time. So it's just so interesting. And what I love about Berkshire is you just realize these little nuggets, whether they were intentional or not or what have you. And it's like, wow, I'd never really thought about it like this, but they're benefiting hugely from this. Or, can you believe they did that? It's just, there's so many lessons to continue to learn from Berkshire Hathaway.
I think the lesson here is if you found something that's good quality business, then hold it forever. And then the tax treatment, it actually works in your favor. And one day, maybe the cost is a fraction of what it's worth today. And there's just no incentive to sell anymore because you can't recoup it by selling and buying something else. The math doesn't work, but that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Coffee can portfolio, that's what I can think of. When I was reading your book, I was thinking to myself, it's okay to be slow. And in the investment profession, especially these days, we feel like we have to be on top of things. We have to know what's next. We have to know what's changing, what's impacting the earnings. That's not how I operate or my firm operates, but that's what I see, the short-term focus mindset that people have. And then Buffett admitted a long time ago how he was very late recognizing Coca-Cola in the 1980s. He had been a consumer already for a long time of the product, but then it took him a long time to recognize it. And it's kind of similar with Apple. By the time Berkshire bought Apple, we were on iPhone 7, if I'm correct, and it was already 5 years after Steve Jobs passed away. So the lesson here, it's okay to be slow, but if you found the right thing, like in both cases, he identified the right business, he still did okay. Can you talk about that? Because we all want to be first, but he was definitely not the first to discover either of the two companies.
No, in fact, I mean, he talks about how he sold Coke, you know, bought a six pack for a quarter and then sold them individually for a nickel. You know, he's recognized Coca-Cola for a long time, and Apple, again, saw his grandkids playing with it and all these stories. But again, you take a step back and you think about the math behind all of this, and you look at an exponential curve, you can afford to be very late, right? Like what's the value that you get by waiting? You get to see if this business is going to work out, right? So Coca-Cola, right. Roberto Goizueta, Buffett could see that Goizueta was bringing the business, you know, back to its core, selling off some bottlers, reinvesting. He could see these dynamics happening. Apple, I think it was proving the ecosystem and the stickiness of it and so forth. But you can afford to be late on an exponential curve. And so I think the lesson there is, you know, you just think it through. If you're wrong and it's not, you know, a straight to the moon type of chart, if you're late, that's good. If it is that type of company, you can still get on board and do extremely well. So again, just both of those things comes back to patience. It just really comes back to patience. I think you have a lot more to gain by sort of sitting back, making sure you understand the investment, the operating environment, the moat, you know, all of that. It pays to be patient would be another big lesson from Berkshire Hathaway.
And it's okay if you feel you're late, because there might be more benefit and growth ahead. Anybody buying Coca-Cola in the 1980s, it was already a 100-year-old company, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that it's past its glory, but what Coca-Cola has done since is remarkable. So Buffett is not shy about sharing his mistakes, and we talked about it briefly. And since you spend so much time studying all of those years, all of those decades, does anything really stand out to you? Was there one mistake that was a really big threat, like danger to Berkshire's survival? Apart from, you know, some of them being a nuisance, some of them being losses or something he backed out of, but something that was a real danger to the business that you noticed or close to it?
Yep. Probably Solomon comes to mind for two reasons. One is reputational. Buffett had, and at this point, you know, mid to late 80s, or when the scandal happened, it was actually 91. A lot of Berkshire's, you know, sort of playbook, again, buying all these businesses, being a home for these businesses, was Berkshire's reputation. And if that faltered or came into question, that could sort of put this whole playbook at risk. You know, what's this guy doing associating himself with this? Or, you know, he's just part of Wall Street and so forth. So that's the reputational side. But there's also just, again, just look at the numbers and put things in context. The $700 million convertible preferred deal that they did in 1987, I think was right around 25% of equity capital in terms of size. And even fast forward to 1991, I think it still represented 10% of Berkshire's equity capital. So it was still large from that standpoint. It was a convertible preferred, so it was higher on the capital stack than equity, but it's still, you know, if the investment bank actually had gone down, had gone bust, that could have gotten wiped out. I mean, that would have been a big hit. I would say that was probably
these,
one
these
of
the two. Why would he do that? Do you remember the context why he decided to go ahead with that convertible?
Yeah, this was part of a string of convertible preferreds in the 80s. Champion International, I think it's a paper company, Gillette and Solomon. And they actually advertised for it at one point that they were willing to do these. And I think it might have been, I have to look back and sort of confirm this for sure, but just a lack of great investment opportunities. Okay, we can put all of this capital to work. We have a known premium here with some upside potential. But it's sort of like, again, with these convertibles, Euro coupon sort of notes, all those sort of on the other side, on the investment side, getting into these convertible preferreds was just, okay, like, you know, we can make this work, or, you know, here's this structure that we can do. And I mean, US Air is another one. You know, did they have any business going into US Air and, you know, kind of repeating those mistakes even closer to the present day? But it's kind of one of these things where they knew they didn't have, Gillette worked out really well for them on the upside. Solomon was, you know, sort of a more on the negative side for sure, at least reputation wise. And so, but they've never done one since, to my knowledge. So it was kind of just this era of convertible preferreds, just kind of interesting.
They were available. Well, you mentioned airlines, and I wrote down a question. What's up with the airlines in Berkshire? Because he owned them for 30 some years, maybe 40 years at different times. And obviously US Air, not the best experience. And then he said so many times he would never buy airlines again. And he ended up buying them and owning them all the way until the most recent pandemic. And obviously he owns a private jets company that's also an airline, just different. But why the airlines? You know, it's like he wants to exit and never be in that space again, and he goes back. What's the story?
I don't know for certain, but I mean, he even joked at one point. He has an 800 number that he calls and says he's an aeroholic, and they talk him out of it. And you know, he was saved by, you know, sort of a fluke on US Air, where they wrote down the investment by a significant amount on their books, and US Air had a sort of a spike in profitability. They were able to repay the preferred, and they got out whole. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, they own NetJets, a company that they own in its entirety, and that had struggles of its own, particularly as they were trying to break into Europe, and they saw that scale was necessary to really make this work. And then up through 2020, I think slightly right before that, where they could see sort of a similar dynamic to what happened with the railroads, where consolidation and industry dynamics and sort of how industry players were acting, you know, they were acting more rationally, capacity was taken out, and you had higher utilization rates. I'm not sure. I mean, it's easy to say that was a mistake because COVID happened, and
right,
they ended up selling those four at a loss. I'm not sure it was a mistake. I mean, I think COVID was certainly just out of the blue, but I mean, they may still have been right about those dynamics, but it's kind of this, yeah, kind of this running theme of a mistake almost at Berkshire of these airline investments. And you know, Buffett has even talked about how it's, you know, it's a sexy business, and, you know, airlines, and you get to fly around, and but if the economics aren't there, I mean, we've seen that they can go south pretty quickly. So I think, at least for me, the story's out on whether the most recent ones were definitely a mistake. I think at the time, I mean, when they sold them, I think it was just, you know, the world is could be potentially falling apart, and they just got out. But
yeah, it's a tough business. It's much more consolidated now. That's true. But he joked about the business and really showed all of us the weaknesses of it. That's why I was surprised that, having all the options in the world, he ended up going back to the airlines. But it didn't stop him, and you know, he made money elsewhere. So it's just a side story to a much bigger, better story. The other thing that comes up in your book that I really like is the liquidity, the ample cash. And you mention it now and then throughout the story, how Buffett was not afraid to hold on to cash, especially if he wasn't finding anything that met his, you know, expectations in terms of buying. And he saw Berkshire as a fortress. And it's really interesting because, as you know, professional investors, there's so much pressure to be fully invested. And that's the mindset, you know, you should fully participate. But that leaves no room for you to have any dry powder when the market corrects and you have more things to buy at very low prices. Just like the pandemic years, we had some windows of opportunity. Can you talk about that cash? He feels so comfortable letting cash pile up. And we're not talking about small amounts. We're talking about, I think, over $100 billion at some point, right? Big numbers that are just sitting and waiting for an opportunity.
Yeah, actually, cash, I don't know what the exact peak was, but it was definitely north of $150 billion a couple of years ago. But even there, again, just sort of taking things in context, it was certainly high, but as a percentage of Berkshire's assets, you know, it might have been around, you know, 15 to 18%, something like that. It wasn't abnormally high as a percentage of you know, equity capital or total assets. So just kind of putting that in context. But more broadly, I think it's just a matter of opportunity cost and having this business owner mindset. And if you're buying a business forever, whether you're actually buying a business in its entirety or investing in the stock market with this business owner mindset, when you make that investment, you are pulling the trigger. You are locking in your future return on that business. If the business doesn't grow margins and returns on capital, your return is not going to grow. And so I think it's having that threshold below which they just won't go, mm-hmm. because they don't want to rely on essentially the actions of others to make up their investment return. They want the business itself to generate the return. And then sort of related to that is where they put the cash. You know, Berkshire, I'd encourage anybody to go back and read the 2010 Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission interview with Buffett. And just talks about how anything can happen in markets. And yep. he will only own U.S. Treasuries. You know, that's basically it. Mm-hmm. He needs to know that tomorrow that capital will be there. And that's the safest thing. I mean, you can't even bank deposits. They won't even reach for, I mean, we looked at when Berkshire was at that high of $150 billion a couple of years ago, treasuries were yielding almost nothing. And so mm-hmm. the certainty of having access to that capital, you know, not losing money, your first job is not to lose money, that plays out in your dry powder as well. It's not just the investments that you make in the investment, you know, the stock market. It could be your dry powder as well. So it really is this self-reliance type attitude at Berkshire Hathaway that we're not going to count on the Fed stepping in or being too big to fail or what have you. We have to survive. And then above that, we want to have that dry powder to make these investments when the world is falling apart, like they did in 2008. They put $14 billion to work in 2 weeks.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And when we talk about treasuries, we're talking about short-term treasuries, given that the interest rates, you know, went up. And I think that was really important. And he emphasizes short-term treasuries that are less exposed to the interest rate risk. Speaking of cash, I want to ask you about the float. So the insurance float is a big part of Berkshire's story. And for those that are less familiar with the concept, can you introduce the idea how Berkshire has a float, how they choose to use it, where it comes from, and how it plays a part really in, you know, the success of the entire business?
Yeah, it's an important part of Berkshire Hathaway's past and its present value. And so I think the simplest way to understand float for those who haven't already studied it or are familiar with it, is to think about your auto insurance premium. So you have to pay, like I pay a year up front for my coverage. And so that cash is going into, I use Geico. so Geico's getting my insurance premium. Well, until they've provided coverage or I get into an accident, they have use of that money. Until it's either earned by them by providing coverage and I don't get into an accident, they get to keep it, or I get into an accident and they have to pay it out. Mm-hmm. In both cases, I think it's easier to understand, okay, you hand over the cash and they have it until they use it. That's sort of one element of float. The other element is the loss side. And it's not very intuitive, but if I get into an accident and I incur $5,000 worth of damage to my car, that's now a liability that Geico owes me to fix my car. Well, if they haven't paid that yet, they're still holding on to it. So there's that other dynamic there where even if it hasn't gone out the door, it's still valuable because they can then take this float and invest it almost essentially where they see fit. And kind of envision it as a stream coming into a lake or a pool or some sort of container. So you have money coming in, it accumulates into this pool, and then it goes out in another stream. Well, that pool can be used for the benefit of the insurer. Now, what I've just described with car insurance is short tail insurance. So lots of money comes in pretty quickly, gets paid out pretty quickly. And so you have, you know, that stream coming in and the stream coming out is very fast. Right?
Right.
Berkshire is also in other lines of insurance, particularly reinsurance and some other things, excess lines and so forth. Those and workers' compensation might be a better example here, where the liability side, it's not just an act. So I get into an accident, or say I, you know, paralyze myself at work, and the insurer is now obligated to make payments to me for my entire life, right? So 15 years. Well, that payment stream is very long lived. The capital comes in and then it gets paid out very slowly. You can have float grow by virtue of lots of money coming in and or slow going out, but that pool just accumulates. Berkshire just made an acquisition, so it jumped the numbers up here, but Berkshire has $170 billion worth of this float. And as long as they can break even on their underwriting, which historically they have, that float is cost-free. Mm-hmm. And over the years, Buffett has equated the cost of float to borrowing, and he's used the U.S. Treasury rate, the long-term Treasury rate, as a benchmark. And over Berkshire's history, they've been able to borrow money by virtue of this float at less than what the U.S. government can borrow. And it's an incredible, it's technically a liability, right? Because you've handed over your cash to get coverage, or they owe you money. So that's a liability for the company, but it has incredible value to the insurer. And the way that Berkshire has structured it such that they either make money on underwriting or break even, it's counterintuitive. It's just hard to sort of think through, but it's economically equivalent to equity capital,
right?
Because you have this permanent self-refreshing pool of capital that you owe technically, but that you can hold on forever and make a return.
Mm-hmm.
And so float has been incredibly important to Berkshire. And the way that Berkshire operates its insurance companies allows it to do these things like buy whole businesses. So BNSF, for example, the railroad, is owned by National Indemnity, that company that they bought in 1967 for $8.7 million. Today is the first line owner of a Class 1 railroad. And Berkshire, again, there's this interesting dynamic within Berkshire of conservatism and aggressiveness.
Right.
So they write very little premium volume compared to the capital that they have. Berkshire has almost half of the equity or statutory capital in the entire world, and they only write about $70 billion of premiums a year. So you have about $250 billion worth of statutory capital, and you're only writing about $70 billion. So you're only writing a quarter of what of your capital per year. Many insurers, and it depends on the line, but many insurers will write a 1-to-1 ratio, or if you get into auto insurance, it might be a 3-to-1 ratio. So Geico, if it had $10 billion of capital, could write $30 billion of premiums. Berkshire's the other way. So by having a very conservative capital position, it doesn't have to invest in quote-unquote safe assets like bonds because the money needs to be there. It can actually lock up returns. It can take higher risk. And so there's these sort of things that just come to your mind when you sort of stop and think about it, like, wow, they're quote-unquote more conservative, but that allows them to be more aggressive. And you just put those two together and it just creates this incredible, incredible asset. And that's Berkshire Hathaway.
You have to know when to be conservative and when to be aggressive. And it's a dance when you're investing, and he's done it. Well, they've both done it over all those decades. I'm really curious about the Amazon investment. And I don't know how familiar you are with it, but you mentioned it in the book, how they bought a junk bond in, it was an Amazon issue in Europe. And I don't know if you know the backstory behind that particular issue, but I cross-referenced this in my own head with a story that I heard about Amazon raising money in Europe almost 5 minutes before the dot-com bubble burst. And apparently that money played a big role in allowing Amazon to survive through what followed, which was the burst of the bubble and obviously lack of any access to capital for any tech company for the following year or two. How much do you know about that issue? I was very intrigued by it when I came across seeing it in the book. I'm really curious if you know more about it.
Yeah, no. And again, this is another instance where it's like, okay, I could, you know, I want to stop and like just research this whole thing and all these little rabbit holes that I did and wanted to go down. Yeah, again, just really so interesting how Berkshire has a history, has a past with Amazon. Again, around sort of the early 2000s, a lot of these, there was a junk bond crisis, junk bond yields spiked, the price went down. And so Buffett went shopping for Berkshire Hathaway. And it was interesting how with this particular issue, the one thing that gave him a clue as to the quality of the issue, and again, Buffett is stepping in here as a creditor, as a debt investor in this case. And so he's more, he's primarily concerned about getting his money back. And if the price of the bonds goes back to par, that they can make a big profit on it. But what gave him the confidence was the fact that Amazon, and I think just two or three other companies, voluntarily expensed stock options. And he wrote a ton about expensing stock options and how they were an actual cost, testified to Congress, wrote a letter saying that they should be. And so the fact that Amazon was voluntarily doing this gave him the confidence to make this investment in Amazon's junk bonds. But I don't know much other than that. I don't think I even knew it was attributed to their ultimate survival and kind of the history of it and where it went from there. I'd love to know more if you have more information.
I'll find that article, and I'm guessing it must have been one of those issues. Because I read an article about a very conservative CFO that Amazon had in those last months or years before the dot-com bubble burst. And I'll look it up, but he's kind of the silent hero of the story, that he made that capital available to Amazon. And the issue was the debt was issued in Europe. So when I read it, I thought it might be one of the same capital raises that Amazon did, and Buffett ended up owning for, you know, completely different reasons down the road, because it was a junk bond that he could get. And he liked the different practices that Amazon had with the options expensing, which is a bigger theme for Buffett, that he had those comments about accounting not showing the economic reality. And he would write extensively about certain things, how they're treated and presented from an accounting perspective and how the economics are different. And this is one of them, options, how companies wouldn't expense them. And he would say, well, if they're not an expense, what are they? And options are,
yeah,
an expense.
Yeah, it's just, and you could probably write, you know, a whole small book on Buffett as debt investor. Again, there was, I forget the exact year, but maybe in the 80s, mid 80s, they bought the bonds of the Washington Public Power Supply. There was five projects, two of them had failed, but they invested a pretty significant amount in the first three projects because there were structural differences in these issues. So just where a lot of people would just sort of pass them off, and just that willingness to kind of go deep into the investment to really understand them, understand the true economic characteristics of the investment, the security that you have as an investor. Just again, you could, you know, Buffett, world's greatest investor, but, you know, sort of also world's greatest operator, you know, debt investor, human relation, like he has so many titles, teacher, that you could attribute to him. I think a lot of these are often forgotten because he's so closely associated with the stock market, but he's so much deeper than that.
He really is. Well, it's a good transition to one of the last questions I have for you, which is Berkshire beyond Buffett, right? So we talked about Berkshire before Buffett, and what happens when both of them, Charlie Munger and Buffett, are no longer participating in the business, or, you know, no longer with us?
Yeah, I think, and Buffett has talked about this and alluded to this, and I think Munger had put it this way. He said, you know, if we haven't already thought about that, you know, we haven't done our job, basically. You know, we've thought a lot about this. And I think it's actually a compliment to Buffett and Munger to say that Berkshire would do just fine without them. I think that's actually the state that they would like Berkshire to be in, because, I mean, certainly the Buffett name, he's motivating. I mean, I had an experience even just writing to him, you know, getting a quick little response back. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, Warren Buffett's, you know, going to be looking at my book. You know, I got to make it the best it can be. And there's a case to be made that that's going to be gone when he's no longer around. But I mean, I walk around the Berkshire annual meeting. I talk to the managers. I have asked them how it is to work for Greg Abel. And I think Berkshire's going to be different, just because it's going to be a different, it retains most of its earnings, and just the future opportunities are going to be different. The company's going to be shaped differently. But I think just from a culture standpoint, it's going to be fine. It's going to do very well. I mean, you just look at Greg Abel, an incredible manager, incredible business operator. And then you look at, you know, we still have Ajit Jain there, where Buffett has said, if we're all drowning, save Ajit, you know, don't worry about me. And then even beyond Ajit, we now have Joe Brandon back as part of the Allegheny acquisition. So, and the decentralization of Berkshire and all of that, I mean, there's definitely going to be a spotlight on the company, and calls for it to be broken up. And, oh, geez, look at this problem. This wouldn't have happened when Buffett was around, or Buffett would have done this. But I think to the extent that the board and shareholders pay more attention and sort of keep up this culture, that will give the management confidence to continue to operate the same playbook. And I didn't even mention Todd and Ted, you know, on the investment side. So I think there's so many positive attributes that will continue beyond Buffett and Munger's lifetimes. And that momentum that they've kept in place for so many years is just going to continue to keep the business really in an amazing place. It will change, but
I'm thinking of physics of compounding. And I don't know if it was Buffett or Munger that said, when you extrapolate growth, you could end up with more lawyers than people in New York City. I think he said that story how if you have that much growth in among the number of lawyers, in the number of lawyers, you could end up with more lawyers than people in New York. Like sometimes the models that we build of growth and compounding. And at some point, given the size of this company, and I think it still has obviously room, but you reach a certain level that you can't grow more than the pond you're in, right? And if the global economy is growing that much and you become so significant and participate in so many sectors, by definition, you will start to dwindle with the growth to the growth of the pond. Do you have some thoughts about it? And Berkshire might be still a small fish in a massive pond when you think about the world as a whole. But in the US, we're reaching a certain level of, there are not that many companies that Berkshire could buy a whole company and choose from. It's getting a little tricky at that size.
Certainly, Berkshire is not going to repeat its historical record. I think for myself, for me, a small margin of sort of excess returns is success. And they've talked about, particularly getting into the more capital intensive industries, it's more about staying rich than getting rich. Right. And so I think sort of on a gross basis, right? Like Berkshire, those opportunities, the opportunity set's going to be smaller, just like you said. But I think at the margin, they're going to be able to add value, certainly on a per share basis. Mm-hmm. The patience that they have in being able to put out a lot of money when panics happen and the Fed doesn't step in, buy into businesses when others panic, buy their own shares when they're undervalued. I think those things will give Berkshire Hathaway a slight advantage. I think if your expectations of Berkshire Hathaway going forward are one of that fortress balance sheet, the Rock of Gibraltar as a base, and maybe just small incremental gains in terms of value when it comes to, again, share repurchases or taking advantages of dislocations in the stock market or lending opportunities arise, or even as a home for businesses, the ability to say, hey, we'll let you continue to operate your business. It'll stay inside Berkshire Hathaway and we're not going to flip it. Those might be small, but the small advantages will compound over time. But I think as long as you set your expectations modestly for Berkshire, it'll still be a very good business, but it will guaranteed not be the near 20% compounded that it was in the longer term record. That's almost certain.
Adam, you wrote a remarkable book. I highly recommend it to everybody. I really enjoyed reading it, and it got me thinking about Buffett in many more ways than I have before, because you have so many little stories. But a question for you, a last one that I like to ask, is about your own definition of success. You invested 5 years in this book. What's on the menu? What are you thinking about? And how do you think about your own success, whether it's professional or personal, as much as you want to share?
The word independence comes to mind. I think that's a goal, be independent. And I think that gives you the opportunity to do whatever you want. And, I invest money professionally. I'm a professional investor by trade. Success for me is being able to achieve that independence, but do well by those who trust me. So it's not become the largest, have the largest portfolio. It's not, it's how I treat those who've entrusted their capital to me. Am I able to get them a safe, satisfactory return? I like what I'm doing, enjoy the process. In no way does size come into that. And I would actually say staying small would be a part of that success, because it means I can continue to do all those things and have good relationships and giving back. I like the idea of teaching as well. So that's kind of all part of it. If I'm able to do something, do it well, earn a good living for myself and give back, I think that will be a successful life.
Yeah, I can relate to that independence. I call it freedom, in a sense of freedom of choice. you get to do what you want to do. I sometimes say that I would do what I do even if I had all the money in the world. I would look up companies. I would do my research. I would find investments. And if somebody continues to trust me with their money, I would invest their money along with mine. That's what I've been doing for 20 years. So if you find something that you enjoy, it's like Buffett says, tap dancing to work. I think that's the biggest dream, that what you do doesn't feel like work anymore. It's just something that you really enjoy. Adam, thank you so much for today. This was a real treat for me, and I'm sure for the audience. And I recommend your book to everybody. So much to learn and such a delight to read. So thank you for putting in the time and effort, because I can only imagine what it took to write it. So thank you.
You're very welcome. This is a lot of fun.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.